Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. A compilation of six fascinating historical true crime stories, all geographically attached or close to the author's childhood home. There's Killer of the Cloth, The Baby in the Convent, Mosquito Point Road, Death of a First Baseman, The Blue Gardenia, and Pure/Evil. And three of the killers are female. The book that we're featuring this evening is Mosquito Point Road, Monroe County Murder and Mayhem, with my special guest journalist and author, Michael Benson. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Michael Benson.
Thanks, Dan. Good evening, everybody.
Thank you. Good evening, indeed. We talked about in the introduction that all of these stories are geographically attached or close to your childhood home. Tell us about growing up in Chile, outside a suburb of Rochester, Chile, New York. Tell us a little bit about growing up there and the proximity to these stories.
Okay, everybody in Chile is laughing right now.
Oh, there we go. Again, I did it.
It's okay. Rhymes with highlight. I grew up on a dirt road called Stallman Drive. It was off of Ballantyne Road, south of the city of Rochester, in the town of Chile. The northern border of our land was made by Black Creek, and Black Creek flowed into the Genesee River, which then flowed northward into Lake Ontario, going through the city as it went. Now, I think people who read The Devil at Genesee Junction are pretty familiar with the area and the murders of my babysitter, Georgiane Formicola, and her friend from down the road, Kathy Bernhardt, 1966.
Yes.
Now, as I was growing up, I knew that Ballantyne Road had years before been known as Mosquito Point Road. And the assumption was that the name change came about because real estate brokers didn't want prospective buyers thinking the area was insect infested. Which it was. I know, you know, my dad never looked at the house after dark until we lived there, at which we were horrified that we had a constant battle against the insects. But as it turned out, that wasn't the reason for the name change. The name was changed because it became synonymous with a ghastly murder, one that took place in 1920, exactly 100 years ago, and at the exact same spot as where my friends were last seen before they were murdered 46 years later. So that was where the idea for the book started. Six stories to varying degrees tied with my childhood home. Some took place right behind my house in Chile, down the road a bit. Some just across the Genesee River in the town of Brighton. And one's in the town of Greece and one's in the town of Irondequoit, which are all simple drives from my house growing up. But the Mosquito Point Road murder occurred on January 8th, 1920. Black Creek's frozen over. Everything's snow-covered. And shortly before noon on that day, the body of a young man wearing only his underwear was found stashed on the ice under the stone trestle just north of Mosquito Point Road. Same trestle as appears on the cover of the book and where Georgiane and Kathy were last seen. It's actually a culvert, and it was built as an aqueduct to carry the Genesee Valley Canal across Black Creek. And by 1920, it was being used as a trestle to take the railroad across the creek.
Right.
Now, the location was described to city dwellers in the papers of the day as just south of Britton Field. I had no idea what Britton Field was, but I found out that it was a one-year-old airstrip that would grow in stages into the Rochester Monroe County International Airport. So the airport in Rochester has always been in the same place since there were airplanes. Now, the bridge was stone. It looked permanent, although today it's in a state of disrepair, a little bit of concern there. Someday somebody's going to walk across the thing and fall into the creek. But it had two tunnels went under it, and they were just high enough, I know from personal experience, just high enough so that you could canoe under the trestle if you limboed back while you were paddling. But back in 1920, the man that they found under the bridge lying on the ice had been stabbed, horribly slashed, disemboweled, his skull caved in, and most disturbingly, his head had been skinned. His scalp was flayed off. His ears were shredded. One ear was hanging by a single thread of cartilage. Now, on the banks of Black Creek, next to where the body had been stashed, sheriff's investigators found two sets of footprints, one male and one female. And the sheriff himself said that it was the most brutal murder he had ever seen around those parts in a long time. Now, the heaviest muddy footprints from the woman were found under a tree about 60 feet away from the body, where there was a large patch of red snow. And resting atop the body was a wooden club that had at one time been part of a railroad tie. There were bloodstains on the club, and it was presumed that the big stick had put the hole in the body's skull. Now, nearby, they found the heel from a woman's shoe stuck in the mud. And an investigator looked around at the female prints and envisioned a woman dancing about in distress as she watched a man being killed in a gruesome way. But as it turned out, that investigator had it all wrong. Investigators agreed that there must have been an extended attack because it would just take a lot of tenacity, a special kind of anger to flail that much skin off of a man. So, but at first, you know, they managed to identify the guy by ID in his pocket. And the big break in the case came fairly quickly when a taxi cab driver from the city of Rochester, a guy named Charles Shearer, called up police headquarters and said he thought he might have given the victim and his killers a ride out Scottsville Road as far as the Ballantyne Bridge. Ballantyne Bridge was known as the Ballantyne Bridge before Ballantyne Road was named Ballantyne Road. The road was named after the bridge. Sheriff's detectives picked up Shearer at his home and took him to the morgue. They showed him the body. He winced, said, yep, that was the guy in the cab. And apparently must have been some face intact. And with him during the ride, he said, was a young couple. There was a man, there was the victim, and the victim was handcuffed to a young woman. They asked him if he had any clues to the identity of the killer couple, and he said, well, he overheard them talking about a man named Arnold who lived on North Washington Street in the city. So that info led to the arrest of Jimmy and Pearl Odell, and they were newlyweds. Pearl was still a teenager. Jimmy was in his early 20s. Pearl had been on her own since she was 14. She grew up in Pennsylvania, and when she was just a teenager, her dad lost an arm in a mining accident and was unable to provide for his family. So she took off on her own to fend for herself. Imagine this in 1920, or in 19-teens, right. This happened. So Pearl has a strong sense of survival, and has no doubt relied on the kindnesses of strangers to get ahead. Well, anyway, investigators learned that the name of the victim was Edward Kneipp, and that's spelled K-N-E-I-P. You know, you keep wanting to say it Kneipp, but we know it's Kneipp because at the time people would often mispronounce it as Knight, like a knight of shining armor. And he was a man who had, before Pearl and Jimmy met, taken Pearl's virginity, or so she claimed.
Right.
Pearl had a reputation for telling a tall tale now and again. And Pearl told her husband that Kneipp had drugged her chocolates. He gave her a Christmas present, a box of chocolates, drugged the chocolates, and raped her while she was unconscious. Well, that news just ate at Jimmy Odell. He was a bit of a hothead to begin with. He'd left the service because of mental problems, had anger issues. But he stewed on this for a long time and came up with a plan. He was going to kidnap Knipe and take both Knipe and his wife out into the country where he would give Pearl an opportunity to punish Knipe for having raped her. Her weapon
Michael,
was going to be an... Yes.
Michael, you're talking about how his plan. Tell us how on earth he could... You talk about the amount of deputy badges that were handed out, say, the year before by the former sheriff. Tell us about more about this plan and this audacious plan, how he pulled it off.
Well, he... Apparently the previous sheriff, there had been strikes. Labor unions had gone on strike. And the previous sheriff had deputized a large number of men to handle any riots that there might be. So there were deputy badges floating around Rochester that you could get for cheap. And somebody would lend you one if you needed to pretend you had some authority for any reason. So Odell has one of these badges, and he buys a pair of handcuffs, and then he goes to Knipe's workplace, flashes the badge, says, you know, to police or Monroe County Sheriff, whichever it was, and they bring Knipe out to him, and he says, yeah, you're coming with me, buddy. And he then takes Knipe to the home he lives in with his bride and his stepfather and stepmother, who been basically his parents. And he makes Knipe confess to raping Pearl, although Knipe never admits that he drugged her. He seems to imply that it was consensual, although certainly statutory, since she was, I think, 16 at the time. And then he puts the two of them in the car, and they're going to head out to the country so that Pearl will be given an opportunity to punish this guy. But his car breaks down, and he ends up getting a cab to take him out as far as Mosquito Point Road and Scottsville Road. And that's, of course, how he gets caught, is that the cab driver remembers who he is. So yeah, so Pearl brings along with her, because she's been told that she's going to be given this opportunity. And I think she realizes, and I believe this to be true, I think that if Pearl had said, no, I'm not going to hurt him, I can't hurt anybody, that Odell would have killed them both as sort of an honor kill.
Mm-hmm.
So she has this 18-inch file, and the file is described as various ways, and there's no photos of it. But Odell's stepmom says that she used to use it to cut ham, although I guess maybe to make hash or something. And Odell himself says he used it to help change a tire. So it's hard to imagine a tool that could be used for both of those things.
Sure.
But an 18-inch file, I think we can imagine. And they go out to the spot near the trestle, and Knipe is handcuffed to a tree. And Jimmy says, okay, Pearl, go at it. And she starts taking the file to Knipe's head. And when she gets started, she decides she kind of likes it. And next thing you know, they're going to have to kill the guy because he has no skin left on his head. So anyway, they're caught. And the resulting trial has to be one of the most bizarre, certainly the most bizarre in Monroe County history.
Certainly.
They were tried one at a time. And these were the days before, yeah, I think even radio, that you had to wait for the newspaper to get the news. So people flocked to the courthouse. You know, you had to show up at 2 a.m. to get a seat in the courtroom. And by the end, by the time they're waiting for the jurors to come back with verdicts, there were crowds of thousands of people outside the courthouse, shutting down traffic. People were trying to peek into the jurors' room. Just mayhem. And the one moment in the trial that really almost starts a riot is that Pearl announces while on the stand that she is pregnant. And that's it. It takes a long time for the judge to get order in the court after that.
There are different versions as this story progresses and as you lay out for the reader. At first, it sounds much simpler. She tells her husband that this person has defiled her, but we hear different details. In fact, there's brought up at trial when they testify that we're talking a little bit more complicated situation because she said he had promised to marry her and there were plans for their marriage.
Oh,
so it was bit more to the story. And as at the trial, you say that everybody wanted to witness this. Women especially were enamored by this incredible thing. The spectators, it was a circus-like atmosphere.
Well, it's just an amazing insight into what it was like to be a woman on her own in 1920. I mean, if we're supposed to believe everything that Pearl says, then she is roofied, raped.
Yeah.
And when she wakes up, she's okay with it as long as the guy promises to take care of her from then on.
Sure.
It's hard to imagine a situation like that today, although desperate people do desperate things. In fact, she gets her reputation for telling tall tales by going around telling people that she did marry Knipe and that they went on a honeymoon together.
Right.
It also comes out in the trial that she and Odell, at first, she doesn't want to marry Odell because she's not a virgin. And he keeps saying, well, no, that's okay. We can get married anyway. But they live together and presumably have relations for weeks before they get married. Again, just scandal, unbelievable scandal. And these are the sordid little details that made the crime so popular. I mean, trial of the century in Monroe County. Pearl was still a teenager, and she sat demurely in the courtroom with a pretty hat on. It would make a great movie, Dan.
One issue that I thought was very interesting, too, was the big break they got was the cabbie coming forward and saying, yeah, I transported these people and I dropped them off in the middle of nowhere here, this Mosquito Point Road. But the idea that he said that they were handcuffed together makes the story and all subsequent stories much different than they went together in the car but weren't handcuffed together. So lends credence to that original theory that he was taking them both out there. So,
yeah. I think so. And it's interesting that they're not terribly lovey-dovey during the trial process. At one point, you know, she says that she'll stick with him even if he goes away to prison. But we're not sure. She's already thinking in terms of her own survival at that point. And during her trial, he's already Sing Sing, for the first time, she starts to talk about Jimmy as an abusive husband.
That's right.
Which
trying to save himself.
Which we could have figured out from the cab driver's testimony. Obviously, the way to do it is to handcuff Knipe to Odell, and there's no reason to handcuff Pearl, and Pearl's going to be less able to stop Knipe if he decides to be aggressive. It only makes sense if he's taking them out there to punish them both.
What's fascinating too, in 1920 yet, or even 2020, the idea of the savagery, the brutality that she inflicted upon this her rapist, she claims, and evidence that would be, but again, the circumstances. People were fascinated by this case, but they were especially fascinated those aspects of it, how much she had done and why. And tell us more about the reaction by media about this case.
Well, it was splash front page headlines in the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle and Times Union for a year and a half. It was like the OJ trial of its day, because it had everything. I mean, it had extreme violence. It had, non-marital sex. It had a woman who turned vicious, but perhaps because she thought that if she didn't turn vicious, she herself would be harmed. So it was complex in that way, psychologically complex. And Pearl's kind of cute. She looks good in a picture in the newspaper, although she was never eager to have her photo taken. I think the only photos, I've seen two photos of her, and they were reused. But one looks like a portrait that might have been taken on a formal occasion, and the other is a candid, a profile. And I know that when she was photographed, or when photographers swarmed her later under different circumstances, she would put her hands over her face. She was not eager to be famous in that particular way.
Story. Let's talk about another story, and I hopefully I don't mispronounce this one. Jean Hetenyi.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, your guess is as good as mine. I think it's Hetenyi.
Good.
Hetenyi. I think you got it right.
Close.
Well, the story starts in a way that's kind of warms my heart in a weird way. It's the story of a 40-year-old odd minister and his much younger wife who's been abused and ends up dead and floating in the Genesee River with a couple of bullets in her, right across the river from where I lived. But the thing that I like about this is that the body was found by a group of children, a guy named Leslie McMahon and a couple other kids saw the body, and they're all still around. They're all still alive, and I got to talk to them. They agree very little on what exactly happened before and after the discovery of the body. As you might expect, memories 71 years after the fact are a little vague. But we went with Leslie McMahon's story because it agreed most with what the contemporaneous reports said. And he also testified at three trials. So we're pretty sure he's the kid who found the body. And he's 10 years old. He went to Ballantyne School, same school I went to from first to fourth. I think we had some of the same teachers. And he said he saw something in the river that caught his eye. He's fishing on a Saturday morning, and he thought it was a dressmaker's dummy. And he stopped fishing because his dad wanted to know if he wanted to go to the store with him. And he said, sure, packed up his gear, went to the store with dad, and came back. And there were police cars there, and he immediately knew then that what he had seen was not a dressmaker's dummy. And he told police that he had been there and seen the body at 9:30 that morning, and that meant he was the first to see it. So he had that. So snagged on a log was the body of a dark-haired woman. She was wearing a white silk dress, faded pink slip edged with lace, a black bra, and pink rayon panties. She'd been shot twice with a .25 automatic pistol, and one of them went through her heart. Nobody knew who she was. Sheriff Elbert Skinner, he was sheriff in Monroe County for 40-some years. He's now appearing for the fourth time in one of my books. He invited people to come down to the morgue to look at the body to see if anybody could identify her, because he says that once we figure out who she is, we're going to know who the killer is. And as he so often was, Sheriff Skinner was right. 600 people show up to view the body, and not a single one has any clue who she is. But because the body was found only hours after it went into the river, it was easily fingerprinted. and the FBI, in a matter of hours, matched the body's fingerprints to that of 25-year-old Jean Hetenyi. She was a Philharmonic violinist, and a wife of an odd preacher named the Reverend George Hetenyi. So investigators called her mom in Oakland, California, said that Jean's first husband had been killed in World War II, the Battle of Leyte Gulf in the Philippines, and that she'd remarried too soon, the mom thought. And the Hetenyis lived in Amherst, New York, which is closer to Buffalo than it is to Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
So Deputy Sheriff William Flynn drives to Buffalo. He picks up an escort from the Erie County Sheriff's deputies, and at 2:30 in the morning, he knocks on Hetenyi's door. And Hetenyi answers all stuffy and chilly. He told the cops his wife had run off, probably went to California to be with her mom. He didn't care anymore, didn't love her anymore. And they told him, no, sorry, she's dead, and she's in the Monroe County morgue. And the reverend seemed bizarrely unconcerned about the tragedy.
Right.
So they put Hetenyi into the car and take him back to Monroe County and into the sheriff's apartment. The sheriff had an apartment then, maybe he still does, I don't know, right down the hall from the jail. So the sheriff and the prisoners were neighbors. And Hetenyi gets into the, they call him Mr. Hetenyi. He says, no, that's Reverend Hetenyi.
Mm-hmm.
Gets into the sheriff's apartment and has a temper tantrum. Breaks a window, knocks over a lamp. And Sheriff Skinner, you know, pins him down and leans on him until he takes the fight out of him. Sheriff Skinner had a reputation for, he was a big man, big up and down, big around. And he could just lean on you and you couldn't breathe and you didn't fight anymore. I don't think he did for 8 minutes. Friends and relatives tell investigators that the Hetenyis had a horrible marriage. That the reverend had lost jobs because they had brawls in public. He once knocked out one of Jean's teeth. He proclaimed proudly for all to hear that all wives need a good beating every now and again. So investigators began to wonder if this guy's a minister at all. Maybe he's just a con man. He'd been a Catholic priest, Episcopalian minister, a Greek Orthodox minister. And during tough times, he took his 47 old station wagon on the road and passed the offertory hat. The car, which was found in his Amherst garage, was a fully equipped portable church. Had an organ that was powered by the motor, had a collapsible altar. They asked his mother-in-law, what religion is he? And she said, he changes religions like a chameleon changes colors. So cops search the car, and they find a clumsy attempt to clean the blood up. Then they find the 25 caliber slug stuck inside the door of the car. That's all Sheriff Skinner has to hear. Book him.
Sure.
That's it. We got him. And it looks like an open and shut case. But as it turns out, that's only the beginning.
He gets... Right away, his behavior is so incredibly odd. He thinks that doesn't have to talk to the district attorney Anthony Michelli, and he thinks that he's compromising his constitutional rights. Tell us what this attorney advises him, and what does he say to police when asked, when questioned?
Well. I mean, the case, his future looks a lot brighter when he is appointed an attorney by the court. Says he can't afford his own attorney. He tries to get a couple of guys to represent him and ends up slamming the phone down. And he's appointed by the court representation by a guy named George Skivington of Scottsville. I went to school with his grandson, Peter, who's now a lawyer himself. And Skivington is a Perry Mason type. He's known for his out-of-the-box thinking and courtroom theatrics. But even before he gets to Hetenyi, Hetenyi's telling a story that he took his wife to a psychiatrist because she was crazy and driving him to distraction. And he comes home without her because she ran off. And this has happened before, but she always comes back after 3 or 4 days. Which contradicts what he said when he first saw the police, that she was probably on her way to California. But that's his story. Doesn't know where she is. And if the blood in the car isn't enough, witnesses start to crop up saying that he was in Rochester. He was in downtown Rochester asking about how the river went and how you get upstream.
Yeah.
After the murder, he was back in Amherst at dry cleaners trying to get some blood stains out of things, and he was changing his clothes in the dry cleaners. So he looks pretty guilty. And then George Skivington shows up, and he fights for this guy like he's fighting for his own freedom. And usually court-appointed attorneys usually say, well, let's see if we can make a deal and avoid a trial. Not George. He says, one, the police never found the murder weapon. They dragged the Genesee River. They used a metal detector, no gun. And two, they don't know where the crime took place. The attendees lived near Buffalo. The bodies found near Rochester. Who knew where the case should be tried? And as it turns out, there are three trials. His convictions keep being overturned. He's convicted the first time of second-degree murder. And then at the second trial, he's convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to death. But that's ruled double jeopardy, because once the first jury said second-degree murder, first-degree murder had to be off the table.
Right.
And you know, his final con job comes in 1966. He'd been in prison for 17 years, usually just awaiting a new trial. And he told the court that to avoid a fourth trial, he would plead guilty to manslaughter. And in exchange for time served, he promised that he would join a monastery and become a monk. But that was a con as well, because he walks out of Attica prison a free man weeks later, but he doesn't join the monastery. In fact, he marries a much younger woman and moves to the American Southwest, where he lives out his years and finally dies in 1977 at the age of 67.
Incredible with all that overwhelming evidence, and it looks, again, like every single time that there's enough to convict him, and this incredible result where he does very little time, almost time served, and walks out a free man.
Unbelievable. And it brings up an interesting legal question, that if you have crime scenes that are in different jurisdictions, where do you hold the trial? And who does the investigation? But it shouldn't be a matter of, you know, the guy gets to go free because of that.
No. It's also an example, that once you get two or three trials in, the prosecution seems to put their hands in the air and say enough is enough in terms of money risked and money, you know, spent. And that's why you get such a dramatic deal in this fourth trial, isn't it?
That is correct. And until he agrees to plead guilty to manslaughter, he never ever admits to killing his wife.
No.
Which is, you know, the smart thing to do. If you happen to have killed somebody, never say it out loud.
Certainly. Now let's talk about another on the opposite side of religion, but at least it has some tie. This incredible story, the baby in the convent. Again, incredible sentencing, incredible trials, and incredible end results. Let's talk about this baby in the closet in a place, Brighton, and Our Lady of Lourdes Convent. Sisters
right.
of St. Joseph.
It's a famous story because it's been turned into a movie, Agnes of God. It was a play. There was a book called Unholy Child, but they were all fictionalized. You know, Baby in the Convent is the first, as far as I can tell, story of what actually happened using the characters' real names. It's, you know, first true crime treatment of this case. And part of that, I think, is because of its sensitive nature. But, yeah, during the 1970s, Our Lady of Lourdes Convent in Brighton was a quiet place. Its residents were all nuns, mostly teachers at local parochial schools, very last place where you'd expect to have a crime scene. But it was Tuesday, April 27th, 1976. It was a crime scene. That was the day that 35-year-old Sister Maureen Murphy, the former Carol A. Murphy, she was an 18-year veteran of the convent, and she was found bleeding heavily from the vagina in her room by her fellow nun. Now, Carol Murphy had been born in Rochester. She was a lifelong Rochesterian. Her dad had recently died, which may have been a psychological factor in what happened. Her mom, Helen, had moved to Florida. She had two brothers and a sister. And she had a little episode that year. She's a graduate of Nazareth Academy, class of 1957, Lake Avenue in the city of Rochester. And the Sisters of St. Joseph ran Nazareth Academy. So if you wanted to go from high school graduate to being a nun, that was a smooth transition. And she took Maureen as her nun name. Excuse me. Now, in addition to becoming a nun, she attended Nazareth College, earned a Bachelor of Science degree in history in 1965, and then a Master's degree in education. And since the autumn of 1975, she'd been the administrator at Trinity Montessori School in Pittsburgh, which is posh sections of the county. And she was considered an expert in preschool education and was often consulted for advice from other parochial schools in the diocese, an advocate for children. Irony of all ironies.
Yeah.
So back at the convent, Sister Maureen's found bleeding, blood everywhere. One nun calls an ambulance, and Sister Maureen is rushed to the hospital. She's a tiny woman, 4'11", normally less than 100 pounds, and doctors quickly determined that Sister Maureen had just given birth. So this was news to all of her neighboring nuns, who said they had no idea she was pregnant and certainly had no idea how she got that way.
Right.
So bizarrely, this strikes me as one of the most bizarre things about the story. Instead of notifying police or calling an ambulance, the doctors at the hospital told the nuns who had brought Sister Maureen in to go back to the convent and search for the baby. Those nuns did as they were told and quickly made a horrifying discovery. They found a lifeless male infant in a plastic wastebasket that had been placed behind a bookcase and out of view in Sister Maureen's room. The baby had a cloth stuffed in its mouth and down its throat. A blue woman's nightgown was tied around its neck, and the nuns who found the baby, they took it out of the wastebasket, wrapped it in a blanket, and took it to Genesee Hospital, where it was pronounced dead. The ambulance attendants who had taken Sister Maureen to the convent were asked if they saw anything suspicious when they were picking her up, and they said, we made a cursory examination of the area, but we didn't see anything. We didn't make a thorough search. Concentration was on the bleeding woman. There was no thought that she'd just given birth because, she's a nun. So,
Did Dr. Edlund, the autopsy was done by Dr. Edlund, and it's mandatory when there's a suspicious death. What were the results of the autopsy?
Well, Dr. Edlund performs the autopsy with Dr. George Abbott, his assistant, and they found that the child weighed 6 pounds, 12 ounces, and had been born alive.
Right.
He could tell that this had been the case because there were traces of oxygen in the infant's lungs and intestinal tract. The child had lived, but only for a matter of minutes. The theory was that Sister Maureen was freaking out and was afraid that her secret would be discovered when the child cried. And in order to keep the child from crying, she gagged it and asphyxiated it. Now, a weird coincidence. I don't know if you remember back in the book Nightmare in Rochester. We talked about a pet store that sold baby bunnies right across the street from a pedophile. And there was an article in the newspaper about the baby bunnies on the morning of one of the double initial murders.
Right.
And we found out that the pet shop sister was Sister Rita, who taught at Corpus Christi School and had been Michelle Mayenza's teacher a year earlier. Well,
right.
Turns out that Sister Rita is a neighbor of Sister Maureen, lives down the hall.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried to get an interview with her because what an amazing life her, what odd proximity to tragedy she's had.
Yeah.
I mean, Sister Rita and I feel like we're in the same club. The horrible things happen to people who are close to us.
Yeah.
Anyway, just when they thought the situation couldn't get any freakier, doctors at the hospital tell Sister Maureen that she's had a baby and the baby has passed away. And she looks at them like they have two heads. She says, "What baby? I wasn't pregnant. That's ridiculous. I'm a virgin." And then, as if on cue, she delivers the afterbirth.
Yeah.
So they do a canvassing of the convent. They can't find a single nun with whom Sister Maureen shared her secret. Couldn't find a single nun who suspected she was pregnant. They all knew she was putting on weight. And she'd said, well, you know, when she does put on weight, it's always in the tummy. There was a question, were the nuns unusually unobservant, or were they liars? It seemed hard to imagine them being liars. Pregnancy in just about every case is a very difficult thing to mask, especially true when you're a tiny woman. Some thought that nuns had to know. The only other possibility was that a nun being pregnant was so unthinkable that they couldn't think it.
Sure.
You know, when did you know something was wrong with Sister Maureen? Police asked. And the consensus was they first knew something was wrong the morning of the birth. She called in sick. She didn't make it into work. Said she had a tummy ache. And when they came at noontime to check on her, they found her in a pool of blood. Law enforcement in Monroe County is starting to feel a little shell-shocked. It was a bizarre time for them. Right at the same time that Sister Maureen had her son, a 7-year-old Michelle McMurray was found dead outside her apartment building on Rochester's J Street. She'd been left alone by her young mom in the middle of the night, went to a corner bar to buy a pack of cigarettes and came back with a man, and she was gone. There was thought that was the fourth double initial murder. Turned out to be a separate case. That was solved by DNA technology years later. And as I wrote about that with my buddy, investigator Don Tubman, in Nightmare in Rochester. There's also a serial rapist on the loose in Rochester, and some thought maybe this explained Sister Maureen's jam. Since late March, three girls aged 10 through 17 had been raped in Rochester's 19th Ward. Two college girls at the University of Rochester had been raped on campus. At knife point, and now they had a baby in a convent. Maybe that was connected. But they did an investigation into Sister Maureen's recent past, and they discovered that 9 months before she gave birth, she'd gone to Connecticut on vacation, and she stayed at her sister's summer house. And she dressed in civilian clothes and didn't necessarily say that she was a nun, and she met a man. and two men from the district attorney's office and a cop went to talk to the guy in Connecticut to see what they could find out. And the guy said, look, I did not know she was a nun. I did not know she became pregnant, and I would appreciate it if my name is kept out of it. And it was.
Wow. Yeah. Different times.
On May 1st, 1976, Sister Maureen is booked in her hospital bed on suspicion of murder. And what follows is, you know, next to Pearl and Jimmy O'Dell, you know, one of the truly bizarre trials in Monroe County history. And we have gavel-to-gavel coverage in Mosquito Point Road.
You talk about attorney Charles Crimmie coming in. And it's crucial, of course, what attorney and that attorney's strategy at trial. What does he set out to do at this trial? How does he try to portray this crime and this woman?
Well, he emphasizes the loss of blood, that Sister Maureen had bled a lot during childbirth.
Right.
And that she was in such a state of shock due to the trauma of childbirth and the loss of blood that she could not be held responsible for her actions after the birth. And there seemed to be some merit in that, although my instincts tell me that there's a certain amount of malingering involved. I'm always suspicious of people who remember everything except for committing murder.
Right.
Yeah, I must have blacked out. You know, temporary insanity. But Sister Maureen eventually does remember that she's not a virgin, and she does remember that she was pregnant, and she remembers reading books to learn about pregnancy. But she never, ever admits to remembering killing the child. Although at one point she says, I must have done it. I was the only one there.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's interesting.
Go ahead.
It's interesting. She talks about intent. When we talk about intent to kill, they asked her about if she ever considered. She knew. She does admit she was. She knew she was pregnant. Other people knew. She went to other people as well. What did she say she would do as an option? What were her plans with this baby? And when they asked her about abortion again, what was her response, which spoke to her intention?
She was horrified at the thought of abortion. She said, I could never hurt a child. Her plan was to keep the baby. And although plan seems like a strong word, because she knew that in order to do that, she would have to leave the convent, and she had never made any plans to leave the convent.
Right.
I think she had procrastinated. She thought she had a couple more weeks to go before she was going to give birth. The going into labor caught her by surprise, and she really didn't have any plans for the future. And as it turned out, of course, she killed the child. So it's hard to take too seriously her plans to be a single mom. She seemed really far away from that. She couldn't even admit that she was with child yet.
Mm-hmm. At trial, too, one of the hurdles, and if we go back to the description of the crime scene as well, when they found the baby in that wastebasket with the nightgown wrapped around her neck and the cloth deep down her throat, or reportedly a pair of panties or some cloth, how did they deal with it? How did the defense deal with those issues?
Well, I think the defense said that Sister Maureen, at the time that she was killing the baby, wasn't aware she was killing the baby. She was merely trying to keep the baby quiet, because Sister Rita had just come home and was outside the door, and the secret would be out as soon as the baby started to cry. And she, you know, the Sister Maureen admitted that she remembered the baby being born. She remembered seeing his arm move. but she never admitted to hearing the baby make a sound, and that may be because the baby didn't. That the stuffing the cloth into the mouth was meant to silence the child, although it's hard to imagine the cloth getting quite that deep down the baby's throat without there being an intent to kill. That's just me.
When you talk about the trial itself, she decided with her attorney not to have a jury and judge alone.
Right.
It might seem obvious why, but tell us about that decision.
Right. Well, they opt to have her guilt or innocence be determined solely by a judge. I suspect that's because they knew which judge was going to be presiding over the trial, and they felt that they would get a fair deal out of him. The end of the case is very, very strange in that he deliberates, comes back, acquits her without comment, not guilty, walks out of the courtroom and goes on vacation and never, ever explains the reasoning behind his decision. And one of my favorite quotes is that there were, of course, nuns in the courtroom who were there in support of Sister Maureen. And one of them says to the other, "Oh, I knew she didn't do it."
Yeah.
Not exactly what happened here. But, I mean, I've conspiracy theories that the Catholic Church made a sizable contribution to the judge's reelection campaign just to make it a little easier for him to make up his mind. And to be fair, I mean, who really wanted to see Sister Maureen put in prison? She had, I think, established a prison for herself that she would always have to live in for the rest of her life. Didn't make any difference if she was in jail or not.
Yeah, was she a sympathetic? And also, she took the stand, which, again, doesn't happen all the time. It's very rare. And in this book, you have many cases of the defendant taking the stand and very dramatic courtroom testimony. What was her testimony like in terms of sympathy? Was the end result in terms of the jurors, were they sympathetic? And would that also allow for maybe the judge's feelings as well?
Oh, sure. Sister Maureen could not be cuter. She is a very sympathetic character. She's soft-spoken. She's sweet, pious. To equate her with the horrible thing that happened was very, very difficult for anyone to do. She sounded naive but educated on the stand. I mean, she talked about reading books to learn about what was happening to her body. And she talked about her embarrassment to tell the other nuns about her situation. And she says that she started to feel otherworldly after she gave birth and described physically shock and how one might feel from extreme loss of blood. And some of it sounded a little bit rehearsed, but overall, it's hard to be angry with her.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody was ever angry with Sister Maureen. People instinctively felt sorry for her because she had made a mistake in Connecticut, and over what must have been an agonizing 9 months of keeping a secret, she never had the courage to face the dilemma she was in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've had people ask me, "Well, what happened to Sister Maureen?" I said, "Well, Sister Maureen fell out of public life. She was never heard from again."
No.
And you know, that's, she is stuck with her own guilt forever.
Absolutely. Let's talk about another story. Again, all of these are close to home for you, but this one you got a message, or pardon me, you spoke to your mother, and there was a person you played baseball with, Dave Harmon, and then you were talking to your mother a few years later, and she asked, do you remember this Dave Harmon? And you asked why. Tell us about this.
There's a
death of a first baseman.
There's a picture in the book of Dave Harmon and me together in our little I think we were 10 years old at the time. I was second baseman. He was first baseman. He was tall. I remember him being a very good glove man. If my throw was in the dirt, he'd scoop it up. And we didn't go to the same school because he lived on the other side of Chilliwack. But we saw each other as teenagers a few times. We ran into each other at grocery stores or something, whatever it was, said hi. But in 1982, I was already living in New York City by that time. My mom calls me and says, you remember Dave Harmon? I said, sure, why? And she said, he's been murdered. Now, these were the days long before the internet. So my mom clipped out the article in the Democrat and Chronicle and mailed it to me. And said that David graduated in 1975, so he was a year younger than me. He went to Olivet Nazarene College in Kankakee, Illinois, south of Chicago, and he was very involved in the Nazarene Church. And he married a girl, really pretty, a little bit of a bubblehead, named Melinda Lambert. They got married when they were barely 20. At the Grace Church of the Nazarene in North Chilliwack. And then they moved to Kansas, to Olathe, Kansas, famous for being the residence of the killers and in Cold Blood when they committed those crimes. But it had become a church town. Nazarene Church pretty much ran things. It's a much bigger place now, and the church doesn't have quite as much influence. And the article in the paper didn't give a lot of details. They said Dave died of massive head injuries inflicted with a blunt object during a home invasion. And for years, that was all I knew. But later, my interest was rekindled, and I learned more details about the crime. And it was about 2:30 a.m. on February 28, 1982, and the Harmon's next-door neighbor, Gail Bergstrand, heard thumping noises on the other side of her bedroom wall. They came from the next apartment. And she woke up her husband, but the sound stopped. Well, Gail couldn't get back to sleep. There's something sinister about the sounds, as if someone was beating a side of beef with a baseball bat.
Yeah.
Now, about an hour and a half later, there's a loud knocking on the Bergstrand's front door. And Gail knew right away that it was connected to the thwacking noise. And at the door is Melinda Harmon, Dave's wife, and she has a small bruise on her cheek, and she seems on autopilot. She's in shock, and she told them that she and her husband had been attacked. So the Bergstrands call the police, and police arrive, and Melinda says a couple of black guys had broken into the apartment and assaulted her and her husband. She said that she and Dave were asleep when she was awoken at 2:20 by the sound of her husband being attacked. The two men had entered the house downstairs through a sliding glass door, and which she had carelessly forgotten to lock, and they demanded the keys to the patron's bank where Dave worked. So she gave the men the keys, and she was taken downstairs. Now, she told the police she overheard one of the guys say to the other, "I think I hit him too hard. I think I might have killed him." One man then struck her in the face and knocked her unconscious. And when she came to more than an hour later, she ran next door to call the police. "All right," the cop said. "Let's go next door and see." Well, they found Dave in bed dead, and their first thought is that he'd been shot in the face with a shotgun. It was the most brutal crime scene these policemen had ever seen. Upon closer examination, they found that he'd been beaten in overkill fashion in the face and head with a round, hard object. So Gail next door was pretty close when she was imagining the baseball bat hitting the side of beef. The scene communicated deep anger. Must have been exhausting to hit a guy 14 times like that.
Jeez.
And Dave never saw it coming. He'd been attacked in his sleep, and his brain matter was splattered across the bedroom wall. He'd been struck in the face between 12 and 14 times, 7 and 7, just like Gail heard, and one of his eyeballs had been knocked from its socket and was found on the rug several feet from the bed. But the weapon was missing. Well, Melinda's treated at the scene for her minor injuries by an EMT who does not believe a word she's saying. This guy has seen injuries that caused a person to lose, and there's tremendous swelling. You would expect a person who'd been knocked cold to have bleeding on the brain, partial amnesia, loss of balance. In the majority of cases where people are knocked cold, they're only out for a minute or two. To be knocked unconscious for over an hour, the injury would have to be traumatic. And here's this woman with a little bruise on her cheek. And also she's up and about, and she's talking and functioning and asking cops if they want coffee.
Jeez.
Not what you'd expect from a person with a concussion. So she claimed to have been in bed beside Dave when the attack began,
mm-hmm.
yet she has no blood on her face or head,
yeah.
and the only blood was on the bottom of her nightgown. This indicated to the investigators that she'd been standing a safe distance away when the splatter began. Her pillow, on the other hand, is well splattered and covered with blood.
Sure, yeah.
So and when police first arrive, Melinda doesn't seem overly concerned about her husband. It's like Reverend Atenye. She's not in grief. She learned he was dead. And the first call she makes is not to her dad or to the church. She calls her and Dave's best friend, Mark Mangelsdorf, who comes over right away. And even though it's the middle of the night, Mark arrives with wet hair as if he just stepped out of the shower. Now, in charge of the homicide investigation is Detective Vernon Wilson of the Metropolitan Major Case Investigation Squad. Detective Wilson drops the bank keys angle completely and focuses his investigation, as he should, on Melinda's relationship with Mark Mangelsdorf.
Mm-hmm.
Mark's a student at Nazarene College. He goes to school at the place where Melinda works. Lives only a few blocks away from the Harmons. He can't really account for his whereabouts at the time of the murder. He says he was home alone, sleeping. Investigators asked around, and they learned that Mark was a college superstar who was expected to go far in life, really smart, really had his act together, and that the Harmons and Mangelsdorf had been quite the threesome. Mark was good friends with both Dave and Melinda. Dave and Mark played hockey together. As we know, Dave's a jock. And sometimes it was weird because Mark's car would be in the Harmon's driveway, even though Dave's wasn't there. And the biggest complicating factor in the investigation is Melinda's dad,
right.
J. Wilmer Lambert. And he's a bigwig in Olathe. He's an upper echelon official in the church and had a lot of elected officials afraid of him. And you couldn't get elected in Olathe without the church's approval, and Lambert had a lot to say about who did and didn't get approved. So it appeared to Detective Wilson that Melinda's dad was doing his best to keep the investigation from following its natural course. Every time he wanted to interview Melinda, Lambert screamed bloody murder, grabbed his daughter, and dragged her away. Now, I think in a lot of places, Lambert would have been charged with obstruction of justice. But in Olathe, his tactics work, and no attempt is made to talk to Melinda, and the case goes cold for years and years and years. And then there's a new generation of law enforcement in Olathe, which includes a relentless cop named Bill Wall. 2001, he gives the case a fresh look, and he decides to drop in unexpectedly on Melinda and Mark, wherever they might be, and see how they react to questions that should have been asked them long before. I knew it was going to be a long road to hoe because Melinda's remarried. She's a soccer mom living in a big house in a nice neighborhood. And Mark is a millionaire. He's an executive with a major corporation, and they can both afford excellent lawyers. And as is true of most of the stories in Mosquito Point Road, the dramatic conclusion to the story takes place in a courtroom.
You talk about the primitive forensic situation the police were in at the time. This is 20 years later, and a fresh look at this. Is DNA part of that fresh look, or is it just something that they say is part of this fresh look?
Well, Bill Wall's really smart. He finds both of the suspects alone when he talks to them. So they don't have an opportunity to compare notes. In fact, they haven't seen each other in years. I don't know if you remember the story of Double Indemnity and Postman Always Rings Twice. Whenever couples get together to murder the husband, they always think that they're going to go on and live happily ever after. But that's not the case,
sure,
because it's hard to build a relationship around a shared murder. And Melinda and Bill go their separate ways. So Bill Wall takes on Melinda first. And she makes some coffee, and they're sitting around, and she says, well, tell us what happened that night. And she says, well, first of all, the guy came in, he was wearing a ski mask. I couldn't see who it was. And right away,
yeah,
he knows that he's got her, because the original story was that there were two black guys, no mention of a ski mask. Now it's one guy wearing a ski mask.
Mm-hmm.
And Melinda, who is... doesn't seem to have a guilty bone in her body in her own bubbly, giggly way, talks for a long time before she realizes that she should shut up and call a lawyer.
Yeah.
Now, with Mark Mangelsdorf, they use a bluff, because Mark knows right away he should have a lawyer present if he speaks at all, and he's probably not going to say anything. But they tell him, you know, well, we've got the new DNA technology, so we pretty much know what happened. And they convince Melinda to cut a deal and testify against Mark. And again, I think they end up getting convictions out of the deal, but both of those killers are currently walking free. Hopefully listening to this.
Yeah.
Killed my first baseman.
You talk about part of that is the defense attorney, Michael Skakel, and he's famous for getting off Kennedy Cousin for the murder of Martha Moxley in Greenwich, Connecticut. So he's a prestigious lawyer, and that's why he's hired.
I thought that Michael Skakel was convicted.
Well, reduced anyway. I mean...
Reduced, yeah.
I,
well, yeah, rich kids don't go to prison forever.
Mm-hmm. It was still a great outcome anyway, so that's cemented his reputation.
The thing of the Martha Moxley case, of course, is fascinating. But the thing about Michael Skakel is he made a crucial mistake. He explained evidence that the police had not yet found.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, he says, you know, if you find any DNA in the lawn outside the Moxley house, that's because I used to climb up the tree and watch Martha through her bedroom window and masturbate. And the police are going, what? We didn't find any DNA in the lawn. But it was an admission like that tends to make the spidey sense go off in a detective.
Now back to the prosecution set for Melinda and Mark. You talk about everything's decided at these trials, and Mark has obviously a good lawyer. What happens? They have separate trials. What happens with her trial? Pardon me.
Well, you know, some of this courtroom action I would prefer people read for themselves. Melinda's not that quick on the uptake, and she says that she knows in her heart that Mark was the killer. Doesn't really explain how she's standing a safe distance away from the attack when it begins, or why it took so many blows, or why anybody was angry with Dave Harmon in the first place. I mean, they went to a church where you weren't supposed to get divorced. But what had Dave done to deserve this? I'm not sure I quite understand the deal. Why all the anger? If Mark and Melinda wanted to have an affair, all right, get a divorce or just do it on the sly. As far as I could tell, Dave's big crime was he was putting on weight, and Melinda no longer found him sexy. And she was just found another tall guy who was going to start up with him. But she couldn't face divorce. And in this sense, it reminds me a little bit about Sister Maureen, that she's so afraid of the church that she's willing to commit the ultimate crime to avoid embarrassment in front of her religious community.
Yeah, again.
Religion does play a big part in this book, doesn't it?
Yeah, and the idea that divorce would be more shameful, or too much of a shameful event, meanwhile they contemplate murder. And also the idea that he goes on to, again, we could say, oh, psychopathic, but it seems so strange that he can go on, have other children, have a life, have a successful business. And even the court seems to look at him that way, and he returns to the streets a free man, that he could compartmentalize that event and move on is incredible.
Yeah, I think that Mark is a genuine sociopath. I suspect that he had the right stuff to make it in business, which involves some of the strong points that sociopaths have. He doesn't feel conscience. He's superficially charming. Being tall helps in the corporate world as well. And he could also brutally kill a man without ever really losing any sleep about it. And his wife seemed faithful to him. She was looking forward to getting him out of prison as quickly as possible so they could go on with their lives and raise their children, continue with the American dream. And how he didn't wreck his chances at the American dream that night in the Harmon's apartment is beyond me.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Now, we have two more stories that we should just briefly summarize, The Blue Gardenia and Pure/Evil, before we have to let you go. But let's talk about those two stories.
Okay, well, the Blue Gardenia story is an article I wrote for 585 magazine in Rochester, publisher and editor Jane Milliman. It's a good lady. And it is about the Mafia War that took place in the city of Rochester during the late 70s and 80s, and a fellow from New York named Joseph Mad Dog Sullivan, who was a freelance professional killer. And by the time he got to Rochester in 1981, he was already a legend. He's the only man ever to escape from Attica prison. He once escaped from a jail on Governor's Island in New York Harbor by swimming to Brooklyn, and it was winter at the time. And as a pro killer, he was the best. He had at least 30 notches on his gun, including Westie's boss, Mickey Spillane. And he's brought into Rochester by his old football buddy at Attica, who needs a guy hit, a guy named Johnny Flowers Fiorino. And the things are a little bit complicated by the fact that, surprise, surprise, it's December in Rochester, and there's a big snowstorm. And the murder takes place in the parking lot of the Blue Gardenia restaurant, which sounds like a film noir movie if I've ever heard one. He is with a Rochesterian who we call Hulk. And Hulk is a bodybuilder. He's not terribly bright, but he knows Rochester streets. And he cannot ID Fiorino so that Sullivan will know he's killing the right man. But once the murder is accomplished, Hulk loses his cool and drives in the middle of a snowstorm out of the Blue Gardenia's parking lot into the middle of Empire Boulevard in Irondequoit, right in front of an Irondequoit policeman who sees a car coming out of a bar parking lot, you know, driving erratically, and figures he's got a drunk driver. But he ends up, of course, running into true trouble. And there's a big shootout. And then the other story, Pure Slash Evil, is about murder of a beautiful woman named Stephanie Joy Kupczynski. And she was a little bit famous even before she became famous for being a victim. She was a very talented violinist, performed in public many times, grew up in New Jersey. And she had a job in 1991 as a music teacher at three grammar schools in the town of Greece. And she lived in the Newcastle apartments, also in the town of Greece, where the super was a piece of human garbage named Ed Larrabee. Jeez. He would be the evil part of the title.
Mm-hmm.
And the story of Larrabee and poor Stephanie is the final story in the book.
Now, this is certainly a compilation of six fascinating historical true crime stories, and so close to your childhood home and connection to you geographically, but yet personally. We mentioned in the title that three of the killers are female. Again, how rare is some of these stories with the predominant killers and such savage killers are female, and also that the idea of these killers being female, but also the trials themselves and these people testifying at trials and these dramatic court cases involving these women. How unusual, all the stories that you've done, how unusual are some of these stories that you present in this six fascinating historical true crime stories?
Oh, they're very rare. When women kill, they because they're often at a physical disadvantage with their intended victim, they tend to use passive methods. Women tend to poison.
Mm-hmm.
And to have one of the female murderers wielding a metal object, a second standing by while her boyfriend smashes her husband's head to a pulp, and the third killing a perfectly innocent newborn child. It's very rare, and it's hard to believe that wasn't my intent when I started to put these stories together. I really was coming at it geographically. The fact that we had so much religion and so many female killers is a bizarre coincidence. Although, you know, if that's the kind of thing you like, then you got to buy the book because it's there, even if that wasn't my original intent.
You also quote, "The wilderness behind your childhood house was a hotbed for violent crime. Unfortunately for some, but fortunately for the readers of your books, isn't it?"
Well, thank you, Dan. I try to tell these stories largely because there are lessons to be learned here. Now, I mean, somewhere out there, I'm hoping, is a woman who is unhappy with her husband and has a boyfriend, and the boyfriend saying, you know, that life would be a lot better if he wasn't around. I hope they give a second thought to committing murder, the easier ways to go about it. I hope somewhere out there there's a young woman who's pregnant and is embarrassed to let anybody know her condition, and is wondering what she's going to do after she gives birth, who realizes that the baby is a precious human being and deserves to be treated that way, despite the circumstances of his origin. And you know, I hope that there's a young woman out there whose husband is older and mean to her, who knows enough to, you know, get the heck out of the house, not to wait around until that kind of relationship reaches its inevitable end.
Yes, certainly. It's certainly fascinating stories, fascinating trials, and then even more fascinating verdicts. So this is an incredible treat, Mosquito Point Road, Monroe County Murder and Certainly Mayhem, Thank you very much, Michael Benson. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much,
for those
much,
that
Dan.
Might want to take a look. Well, thank you. For those that might want to take a look, tell us about your website and Facebook pages, if so.
Well, yeah, you can find me on Facebook as author Michael Benson, and I'm the Michael Benson with the white beard, although I recently
yes.
shaved because of quarantine and heat. But I'm the guy with the white beard, and the Mosquito Point Road and all of my books are available on Amazon.com, where you can also look me up and put all of my books on one page for yourself.
Also, just before I go, I want to apologize once again, because this must be about the second or third time, to the beautiful town of Chi-Lai for
Chi-Lai,
massacring its name. Chi-Lai, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. So.
Oh, you know, and we're so used to it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Michael Benson.
It, as always.
Thank you. Good night.
Take care. Good night.